What does it mean to be female-led, and how are things slightly different or a lot different based on female leadership?
Welcome to the Technical Difficulties Podcast. I'm Liz Gerber, and a design professor at Northwestern.
And I'm Lauren Lin, and I'm a student who has also worked in the design industry. Each week, we speak with women leaders in design and technology.
We are so excited to welcome Erin Huizinga, the founder and CEO of Desklight. Desklight is a studio that designs equitable learning strategies and tools, making learning more exciting, future-focused, and accessible. Erin is passionate about helping both individuals and companies unlock their potential to use innovative learning solutions. Erin has spent the last 15 plus years at some of the world's largest and best consultancies, such as Gensler, Gravity Tank, and IDEO. She was also featured on Chicago Inno's Women's Founder in Chicago Tech. Erin's most recent pursuit is a book titled Learning in the Wild, 21 Ways to Make Learning a Daily Habit and Avoid Getting Caught in the Wild Without the Skills to Survive. This book is so exciting, and I've been going through it so quickly, loving it, really looking at how is it that learning happens daily in our natural lives, and how can we even make more opportunities for learning, just doing the regular things that we're doing. So we can't wait to hear about Erin and how she's taking really a learner-centered approach to design and her journey as a design entrepreneur. So welcome, Erin. We're so excited to have you here.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting me to do the podcast with you, Liz. I'm excited to be here.
Yes, we are so excited. So we must ask you, just as a startup, what was the favorite thing that happened to you this morning? Highlight of the morning.
Oh, goodness. Highlight of the morning. Well, it's the last day of school today for our son, Knox, who is graduating, quote unquote, from seventh grade. So he's very excited, and taking him to school for the last day was exciting for him. And we've got, you know, the big graduation for the eighth graders tonight, and a show, and he's running tech for the whole graduation and show. So pretty proud of him.
That is very impressive. Very cool. Go Knox. Okay, next question. What is your favorite creativity tool? You can define tool however you'd like.
Yeah. Well, Desklight is a virtual office, so we use lots of tools that help us do that kind of work really well. So my brain right away goes to Miro because we use it all the time in virtual workshops, and also we just use it to riff as an internal team. We just kind of get in there, and that's kind of our go-to, almost like we always do with Post-its offline. You know, now we're like, okay, pull up a Miro board and let's brainstorm this out together if we're on a Zoom call together. So lately, it's been Miro for sure. And then Slack, I think, is creative too, because it gives us creative freedom to communicate in a way that we would have never been able to without something like Slack, in such a nice informal way. And then Canva has surprisingly been really exciting to me, along with many of the new AI tools that are coming out almost daily right now around infographic making. And, you know, it goes on and on. And I was just reading some articles this morning. I'm just like, wow, this is really exciting times to see literally every day some of these new tools that are coming out. And for me, as a graphic designer by trade who went to design school, you know, it did take me a while, to be honest, to be less resistant to some of these tools that make things so much easier and efficient as it relates to graphic design and technology and making things rather fast. But they're just getting better and better and better. And so I'm less resistant and more excited now about some of these tools that can make our work shine even brighter than it could if we were taking weeks and weeks to build something in InDesign or back in the day, Cork, for example.
Can you dive into that a bit more? I find the psychology interesting. Were you resisting because the quality wasn't as good? Or why do you think, what's at the core of the resistance?
Yes, I was absolutely resisting because the quality wasn't as good. You know, I was a trained sort of modernist, Helvetica all the way kind of designer from design school. You get this stuff sort of beaten into you in the best possible way. You know, art school does that to people. And some of these initial tools that came out that really were more for, you know, business people, I would say, and people that knew that they could potentially hire a designer or design team or comms team, but it might not be cost efficient for them or something like that. So these tools felt bumpy to me, less refined. The typography level of premiumness was definitely not there at first. And I just had always felt like there weren't designers behind the scenes making those tools come to life so that others could use them. But nowadays, I feel like there is absolutely a strong, strong design team behind these AI tools and even things like Canva to make these things more accessible.
I just have to circle back to the Slack thing. I'm curious what your Desklight's most used Slack emoji is. Slack emoji. I feel like that says a lot.
Oh, I love that question, Lauren. Part of our Desklight brand is use emojis, you know, and so we use emojis in our proposals. We use them in our client communications. And because one of our brand attributes for Desklight is let's have a good time with this. Let's not take this so seriously. And we want to be the best part of people's days as it relates to client relationships and also, you know, helping each other have great days when we work on things, even in challenging days. So I love the question about using Slack emojis because we all use them and we have a great time just thinking about what am I going to use today, you know, and even the consistent, you know, emoji that tells people if you're in the office or you're working from home or, you know, where, what your status is. I've joked with the team the last few weeks and I just have that big bang, you know, symbol emoji boom. In there.
Yeah.
100% of the time, like don't clear the status because there's so many exciting things going on right now. So that's my joke to the team. Like everything's great. You know, I'm always like exciting and lots of exclamation points right now. So that's been my favorite lately. And yeah, we move around, we move our statuses around, we move, our emojis around, we use them in almost literally every communication. So we have a great time with it. So love that question.
Awesome. Okay, maybe we can bring it back to design journey a little bit. And so it was a very fun tangent. I love Slack emojis. But we wanted to ask, what was your, like, I'm a designer moment? Like, did you have that all your life? Was there like one moment or was it like in retrospect where the dots started to connect?
Yeah, that's a great question. So in design school at Portfolio Center in Atlanta, I had that moment. It was a breakdown breakthrough moment where I can literally picture it in my mind. I was struggling as a young design student. I felt like I wasn't getting it. I had a very hard on me teacher. I will be thankful till the day I die for this woman, Sylvia, who was my teacher, but she was the boot camp teacher where it's like, you're going to thrive or die in my class, basically, you know? And I was really struggling in her class at that time because I couldn't quite get a sense for design hierarchy. I couldn't quite get my typography choices to be right in her mind. And I knew it wasn't right. I could see it, but I didn't know how to do it. I couldn't quite get to that level of refinement in my own craft, in my own design at the time. And another teacher, Melissa, had shared with me a list of 10 attributes of good design. And that cracked the code a bit for me in those moments of struggle. In that, you know, I could like go through the list then and really check myself and think more diligently about how I was performing as a designer inside of these 10 things. And I practiced through that. And a few weeks later, I started to improve. It wasn't an overnight change, of course, but I started seeing and feeling the gut reaction of, I think I'm getting this now. I think I'm starting to make this better. And my choices with my, you know, 100, 200 sketches I had to bring to a class every week, they were getting better and stronger. And my teachers were starting to respond more favorably. And my end of quarter critique was better. So that there was a quarter during the 2 years of design school, probably third or fourth quarter out of 8 quarters, that I felt like, okay, I think I'm starting to get this. And I was sitting in the dean's office, Hank Richardson. And I said, okay, I think I'm I think the bulk of my work is improving. And he's like, you're absolutely right. It is. Keep going. And it was, I'll never forget that moment. So if I had to pick one moment, Lauren, from all of that story, I would pick that moment with Hank, because I felt like he saw me and he knew, like, okay, you're on the right track. And he empowered me to keep going in that moment.
It sounds like, Erin, I love that story of the list. It sounds like having criteria can be very motivating and inspiring. Do you happen to remember the principle that you found easiest to follow and the one that you found more difficult to follow in good principles of design?
Yeah. The thing that really helped me with typography was, this is definitely in the weeds a little bit on typography rules, but the X height rules of, you know, lining things up with the X height, which is essentially the middle of a lowercase letter. And you look across a line and, you know, you see some symmetry around the X height of letter forms. And then you start to think about how you can use a line of typography as art, and less about legibility and more about what are you going to do with that line of type that would be more interesting. And you can start to turn it and you can write it, you know, up on the left side and down on the right side. And so that X height rule was a principle written down that I didn't quite understand, because it was all kind of gut subjective intuition at that point. But seeing that helped me. And that is something that I got right away. I think another thing that I struggled with initially was the idea of warm and cool colors. So color theory and how to mix warm and cool colors, essentially complementary colors, to provide a mood or to express, you know, color is something to use as a as an art form of expression and emotion. And that one certainly took a lot longer to kind of get, you know, just to get my head around and to really express myself well through color. And now I love it. And I think if I hadn't gone through, you know, those experiences and understood how color can magnify a message and create emotion where emotion isn't there, I wouldn't love it. I wouldn't love color as much as I do today.
I love that. Also, I'm a typography nerd, or like, I'm always looking for new fonts to download for fun. So I totally relate to that. And I know your background is in graphic design, but now you're in like educational technology and educational instructional design. So what was that path, or was there a transition, or was it natural? And like, what got you interested in that niche of design?
Yeah, I'll connect the dots between graphic design and what we're doing now first, and then I'll share the whole story. So what gets me out of bed every morning is creating educational experiences, learning experiences that are equitable, that are fun, that are learner-centered, and that are actually expressed well. You know, I really feel like all learning experiences should be as great as any big brand that we've ever had the opportunity to work on. So you know, I've worked on all kinds of big brands like P&G stuff and, you know, Office Max and Prudential and PNC Bank. And we spend so much time on big brands really thinking about how to express, you know, the value proposition, a mood, a holistic experience. And so why shouldn't learning experiences be as good as any consumer experience? So that's my big drive and that's my big why. But to kind of circle back, I started as a young graphic designer after design school. And then I got to kind of work in these innovation places. So I'll never forget when I started at IDEO as a freelancer, I got to work on all these different things and work with all kinds of different people. And so that really transitioned me into more of a design strategist and a design leader. And then I was working at Gravity Tank, and there was a Gates Foundation project that came in when I was there. And I was also teaching at Northwestern, and I taught a little while at Institute of Design. And I had started a nonprofit, which is a whole nother part of my story. And so I had this sort of entrepreneurial love for social impact and also the very beginning of the seeds of thinking around, wow, if Gravity Tink can work on a Gates Foundation project, what if we started something that could work on education and learning projects like this all the time? How cool would that be? I would want to do that all the time, you know? And so so that's kind of the full circle all the way around. And so once I figured that out, that I wanted to start a business that could work on learning experiences and social impact projects all the time, I started to chip away at, you know, what could that look like and align with partners that would allow us to build a portfolio of stories and projects that would get us there eventually.
And thank you for that. You referenced it earlier, but you said you you have a unique business partner, and you said you often reflect with him at night after after a long day. You run a business with your husband. Is that correct?
Actually, he's not as involved anymore. I'm 100% owner now. So I know we'll edit that out a little bit.
We will totally edit that out. I'm so sorry. I didn't. That's awesome. Now I want to know more. I'm even more fascinated. We don't have to go down this route.
We started it together as co-founders, and he's an advisor now a little bit. Okay. You know, we have an advisory team, but okay. It's just me. Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Erin, mm-hmm. That's so interesting. Thank mm-hmm. you for sharing that. A good update for me. Okay, I'll go back to the script. So the next question is, what is a surprising thing that you've learned in your journey so far? Something unexpected, something that you would share with young designers?
Yeah, I would say, you know, something surprising that I certainly didn't know as a young designer coming out of undergrad and even grad school, you know, just taking some time to really get out of your chair. I like to say, get out of your chair, see life, see the world around us. And those experiences are really going to get us to be better designers and meet the needs of our client partners or meet the needs of, you know, whatever it is that you're doing in an in-house situation to, you know, push the cause forward, make the product or service better. You know, we can't get insular. And, you know, I think that's really important advice for young designers because we all work really hard. There's a lot of really long hours. But in that moment where you start to feel like you can't see the forest for the trees and you're getting really insular in your thinking, those are the moments to say, you know, to your boss or to your manager, I got to get out of here for a while. I have to like really refresh my brain. I need some deep thinking time. Or I need to go to the museum. I need to travel and do a field trip to learn more about what it is I'm trying to solve for. So being bold and brave and that self-knowledge of knowing what you need.
I love that.
Designer, you can.
That's awesome. I love how you referenced a chapter from your book, which I was just reading a little bit last night before I went to bed. There's another chapter that I really liked. It was about create tension. And how you need to create tension to have deeper, more fulfilling like learning experiences. You retain the knowledge better, and it's a more like full experience. And I was wondering if you could talk about when creating tension has been helpful for you in your career and for growth, because I think sometimes that's scary and hard, but much needed.
Where my mind goes with that question today, and it might be something different tomorrow, is giving ourselves a lot to do. And it's sort of a counter argument to what I just said about, you know, taking time to talk to people about projects, but creating tension in that, you know, you're giving yourself lots of data points and you're giving yourself a lot to think about in order to then synthesize all that information on your own and peel it back apart again so that you've created something new, you've found something new. So I think it's just the season that I feel like we're in, that I'm in right now, and that there's so many things going on and lots of clients that that have very diverse needs, and the projects are very, very diverse. But I've been telling the team, this is a great thing because we can cross-pollinate the learning and really holistically as a design office be thinking more broadly about what those tensions are and how we learn from those tensions. So that's a bit more of a macro answer than a micro answer, but that's what's on my mind today.
Thank you, Erin. So speaking of tensions, you have had an incredibly successful career. You've written a book. You've worked for the top design firms. You own your own firm. Was it all easy along the way? And in particular, is there a story? I see you nodding. Is there a story that you can share that that helps us realize everything wasn't always perfect? Sometimes there were some failures along the way.
Yeah, gosh, it was definitely not easy. There's a lot of bumps on the road. Entrepreneurship is hard. The highs are very high and the lows are very low. And it never really stabilizes. So, you know, it's always a journey, but I love it. I love that life feels, you know, so exciting in all of those ways. I've done a lot of things that were experiments, I would say, at this point, you know, businesses that have been started that didn't work for a number of reasons. And so, we started Epic in 2008, a nonprofit, and had a lot of lessons learned there. And it was really successful for about a decade. And then, you know, Till School we started, which I started. And that was an experiment with a gap year program for teaching design. And there were a lot of reasons why I think that the market wasn't quite ready. It was a tipping point thought. And, you know, Liz, you and I could compare notes on all of this as well. And I think it was just too early, perhaps. So there's that. And then a dear friend and I started the Camaraderie a few years ago, which was experiment in teaching design skills in all of the ways, you know, tactical design, but mostly innovation design to business leaders and people in different offices. And so we had lots of great instructors come in and teach with us for, I think, 5-6 different classes. And Deborah and I decided, you know, it's something that we feel like isn't as scalable as we would want it to be. And there was a lot of work to get classes off the ground. And so there were some considerations there. And ultimately, we decided to move on from the Camaraderie. So all of that to say, that's just the entrepreneurship stories. In addition to, you know, starting Desklight, it did take quite a long time. We've had the business for about 9-10 years now, and started it as a social impact firm, more holistically, taking on projects like community development projects, healthcare, and education projects when we first started. And there were several community development projects I was working on, having been at Gensler and helping run the consulting studio there. There was some nice downstream projects that we would get because of those relationships. And but, you know, as we went through and working on that diversity of client base, the team and I would start to talk about, okay, what do we really love doing most? And again, back to the story of education projects, like what do we really love to work on? And the whole seed of starting our own business, I just always went back to wanting to work just on education and learning projects. Those were the ones that were most fruitful and exciting to me. And so slowly but surely started to carve away at how do we just work on education and learning projects? Those are the ones we need to really focus on. And I think that's one of the most challenging parts about being a business leader and a founder is knowing how to focus. Because when we all start, you want to kind of solve all the problems and, you know, chipping away and saying like, hey, this is what we got to focus on. This is what we need to be known for and what we want to be known for. Also, those things have to align. And being brave enough to say, yes, we're just doing this one thing initially really, really well. And so it took us a while to get there, but it's been so fruitful deciding at the end of 2019, early 2020, to rebrand to Desklight and just go 100% in on the kinds of projects that we're doing today. I love it, and I couldn't be happier with the portfolio of projects and relationships we get to work on every single day.
Yeah, you have the bang emoji on.
Yes.
On top, yes, exactly. On your status. So I know that Desklight is a woman-owned business, and you mentioned you made the strategic choice for you to take 100% ownership. So can you tell our listeners, and I don't know much either, a little bit more about the context of that decision and then the thought process behind that choice?
Yeah, being a woman-owned business has been a really neat adventure to be able to talk about being a 100% owned business versus my husband and I, who co-founded it together. We were both co-owners at the beginning, but we decided to make the strategic decision and choice to move forward with us being 100% woman-owned for a lot of reasons. You know, functionally, it helps with RFPs. People are more and more increasingly looking for women-owned businesses to partner with and minority-owned businesses to partner with. So it's been strategic in that way, in a tactical sense. But it's also been really rewarding to be able to kind of point to the fact that we run a woman-owned business, I run a women-owned business, and we hire a lot of women too. And so a lot of the meaning to me in starting and running a business comes from this idea of the backbone of female leadership and, you know, really helping to create that conversation in our design industry around what does it mean to be female-led and how are things slightly different or a lot different based on female leadership. And in my own career, I've had a lot of really good experiences and bad experiences as it relates to leadership teams, working in consulting firms my whole career. And so it's really important to me to hold up the pillars of, you know, what does balance really look like? What does space to reflect really look like? Even what can huddles do differently and function differently in terms of bringing your whole self to work and what's inspiring you every day, every week. And, you know, just those little but very meaningful changes, I think, have a big effect on not only our internal team dynamics and culture at Desklight, but also how our clients see us differently and how we work with them differently. So I would say our workshops even function strategically differently than a lot of the things that I had seen and been part of earlier in my career at different agencies and innovation firms. And so I bring, you know, the 20 years of reflection and riffing in the good parts and the bad parts and bring all of that into really wanting to make a difference in the industry by being humble, transparent, honest, fun, breaking some of those mentalities around what design leadership has to look like, according to some people.
Yeah. Do you have examples of what that looks like, either at, I don't know, your team huddles or examples of, like, what does it actually look like to lead with care and compassion and also minimize burnout? Because that's, like, a big conversation at work right now. And I feel like not a lot of leaders think about that, but once you put that need at the center, like, how does that change the way you're able to work?
Yeah, the minimizing burnout part, I think it's a grand experiment, right? But we've had a lot of open and honest conversations at Desklight about that. And for example, a few months ago, we had this pretty profound conversation about the fact that high functioning people that are really passionate about their work oftentimes don't really know when to take a break or when to quit.
Yes. Or like if you're in a creative agency or like creative job, you're like, well, I get to be creative all the time.
Yeah.
So it's like, well, work is like fun, but then work is also still work at the
end
of the day.
Right. So it's good to be in that place where you don't feel like work is work. And that's the dream, right? Like we get to a place where we can do work that we feel like matters and it's full of our own purpose and we don't get tired from it. That's when you know you are doing the right thing. But yet we all need breaks. Humans need breaks. And we even talk about the idea that, you know, our brains function better as muscles do. If we take breaks in between things, we'll come back stronger. And so, you know, what does that look like? We've put a required quarterly mental health and wellness day on the calendar for ourselves. So that's part of our benefit, yes, but also a requirement for those of us who find it challenging to take those breaks. Unlimited vacation time, which I know a lot of people have experimented with, either well or not so well, depending on the company culture that that's getting introduced into. But we have unlimited vacation time, and we're just very accountable and honest about what we need from each other. In addition to that vacation time and mental health and wellness time, we just say, like, look, I'm really feeling burned out today, or I'm really at my end today and I'm tired. So I'm going to take the rest of the day and come back in the morning and finish this. And so I think the beginning of it is honesty and transparency. And then I think the second part is putting some good systems in place to be able to minimize burnout. And I think the third thing is being part of a culture that respects and honors the fact that we have long careers with lots of different desires, each individual person, and having those conversations, you know, quarterly about where are you going, what are you interested in learning next, and how can I support that? And, you know, in my previous experiences as a consultant, there's been a lot of firms that, in order to sort of force fit a person into a role, whether they like it or not. And I've always tried to think about it differently around, okay, is this person really enjoying this role? And if they're not, how can we shift things around so that they're enjoying that role more, or shifting into a role that they will enjoy more? And then how do we fill in that gap after that? And I think that has a lot to do with minimizing burnout too, so people feel ultimately happier with what they're doing every day.
One last question to end on, all around advice, a little like mentor moment. So you're a designer and a founder, entrepreneur. Do you have any advice for young designers who might want to start their own studio one day, or have the courage to carve their own path rather than just going to like the studio or consultancy route?
So many things. Yeah, I'd say if you see an opportunity to fill that's not being filled, then there's something there to explore. And it always has to come from a need, you know, not just a passion that we personally have, but it has to come from the outside audience's need. So I think that's true for products, of course, but it's also true for service-based businesses, you know, solving a problem for people holistically. So always documenting, journaling is really good to just continue to get those thoughts out there. Entrepreneurship journaling is really great, where you know, talk to yourself about the needs that you see out there in the world and how you want to solve those. And then you can continue to check yourself month by month by month to say, am I still really interested in this? Is this something I want to dedicate pretty much all of my time to professionally for a while? So I would say, you know, journaling, giving yourself a few months to really test it out and make sure it wasn't just a whim, of a week of interest, right? Just really the dedication and the passion and the spirit for it, is important. And then getting a great set of mentors, informal and formal, you know, there's lots of different definitions of what a great mentor-mentee relationship looks like. I would say anybody who has interest in what you're doing, and also somebody that you feel like you can learn from. So sometimes mentor relationships are literally just a coffee for 45 minutes, maybe 2 hours if the conversation is really fruitful, and that's it. And that's okay. You know, it doesn't have to be a long, you know, 8 week, 6 month relationship. Sometimes people are really interested in your ideas, but they really only have, you know, a little bit of time to spend with you. But that's okay. And that doesn't make it any less valuable. So, you know, big and small relationships as it relates to mentorship. And also thinking about, you know, if you do make the leap and, start the business, thinking about, you know, what else might you do to scaffold that experience? Very tactical, right? Like, how are you going to make ends meet? How are you going to make sure that you have enough to pay the bills and to support yourself and maybe a family? So when you make the leap, you don't have to do that necessarily 100% of the time. There can be ways to scaffold so you continue to learn about that opportunity that you have as an entrepreneur, to partner with other people, to continue to, you know, make sure that you can do that. So for example, I've been talking with a woman who is starting her own business that's different than Desklight, but I've been saying to her, how about you come in and you run this part of Desklight as this particular piece? And it's a win-win because we get your 20 years of thought and expertise, and you have the opportunity to start your own business and not work full-time with somebody else. So I'm always thinking about how can those relationships be win-win on both sides, and as we're all, you know, figuring out life together in that way. So those are just a few ideas initially.
Erin, thank you so much for your time.
That was Erin, and you can find out more about her work in the show notes. And you can learn more about this show by going to technicaldifficultiespodcast.com. Drop us a note at technicaldifficultiesteam@gmail.com or leave us a review on your favorite podcast app. It really helps people discover the show. We're especially curious to know what stories and insights resonated.
This show is produced by Lauren Lin and Liz Gerber and made possible by the Center for Human-Computer Interaction and Design at Northwestern. Thank you so much for listening.